For the people who were here this morning, welcome again, and for the new people, welcome. I'll do a very quick introduction of myself, just for the new people, so who knows who's up here. So I work for a company called Riskier. We basically attack hardware, break stuff, and then we explain our customers how we did it. And there's a bunch of techniques that we use. So this morning I was talking about side channel analysis, which is one of them. This afternoon I'll be talking about fault injection, which is a related but still very different one. We basically do the testing for our customers. We do also certification for them. So in case they're interested in, you know, like an EMV Co or a CC or some pay TV certifications, and so that's also what we do. And besides that, we also sell these kind of tools. And like I said this morning, I'll try to stick with the tools and or the techniques and not so much focus on the tools, because I don't want this to be a vendor pitch. It's about the, you know, the attacks and the defenses. So my name is Jasper. I'm originally from the Netherlands. I actually live in San Francisco now for about for almost 4 years. So I'm heading the office in San Francisco. So I'm basically heading the pen testing teams there. I have a background in computer science, artificial intelligence, and I've been doing security since a long time. So this is a quick overview of the steps that I'll go through this afternoon. Just like this morning, I'll just throw you guys in the deep end and show you how an actual fault injection on a target works, and then the rest of the afternoon we'll peel it apart and try to get into a little bit more depth on the different techniques used to give you some more background. I have two main demos in here. One of them I'll just do in a second, which involves glitching a device out of a loop. And I have another demo later on where I'll glitch an RSA computation, actually a signature computation. I'll glitch it once and I'll actually extract the entire private key, which always sounds like magic to me. But in the session after that, I'll show you that there's some math behind it that actually works out. So I'll take you through the fundamentals, analysis of the targets. I'll show you some pieces of code and then ask you where you would glitch it. I'll talk a little bit about the process of finding how to glitch the target itself, DFA I mentioned, and at the end I'll have a quick session on some countermeasures that you can implement against fault injection. But there was a good question this morning. So even though I'm coming from a lab perspective, so I'm talking a lot about attacks, it's good to remember that each attack is based on certain assumptions. If you want to prevent the attack, what you basically are doing is breaking those assumptions, so an attacker cannot apply that specific attack. So that's if you're coming from a side that needs to defend against these attacks, those are things to keep in mind constantly when I'm talking about these things. Feel free to ask questions anytime. You know, let's deal with them when they're relevant. And I say we, unless there's questions already now, I say we get started. Oh, yeah, one more slide. So just to put really the goals of this afternoon. So I'm going to be focusing on the basics of fault injection. So I'll touch upon a wide array of topics, but I won't go very deep, just so you have an idea of the flow and kind of the variations involved. And I'll demo some attacks on the embedded device that I have set up right here. So you can, in a break or later, you can come and have a look what's up here. Okay, so let's start with the first demo. We'll start off by just having the device do its normal behavior. I'll explain to you what's happening here. So you see this this counter increasing? Every time there's a counter increase, what's actually happening is we're resetting the board. The board at that point enters a test program, which basically for a certain number of iterations does a for loop. We're actually, if you look at this data. What we're specifically doing is we're telling the device loop X times and increment the counter and then return to us what that counter is. So if everything is well, if I tell it to loop 10 times, I should get 10 back, because that's how many times it's incremented the counter. Now the whole goal of fault injection is to make the device do something else than it's programmed to do. So what we want to see is I send it, you know, loop 10 times, I do some magic over there, and it actually doesn't send us back 10, but it sends us back some other number, which actually shows that I've influenced the program flow. I've either broken out of the loop, or I've corrupted a value, or something's happened. Which normally, if you're coming from a software perspective, your chip always does exactly what you instruct it to do, right? So we're breaking that. So we're going to say, even if the assembly code says increment this value, that might actually never get executed, that piece of code. So we're playing with the hardware, and we're going to cause some higher level effects that should become visible here. Now, the reason that this is static is because I have this whole flow going with, if I refresh it, see it's still going, I'm still sending it counters and sending the counters back. But just for this first part of the demo, I have actually not connected the fault injection device. So that's why it's working just perfectly. So just to give you a quick rundown of what I have here down here, you'll see it come later, is a little embedded board. It's an ARM Cortex-M4 that we programmed with this loop. This giant device on top of it is actually a very strong pulse generator. So what it actually does is it charges up, and then as soon as my glitching device here says, okay, now generate a strong pulse, it will discharge and just generate a huge blast of EM. So it's just a large pulse that you generate. This on the circuit will actually generate some currents. So in the chip, you're going to induce some currents, and those will actually affect the computation on the inside. So that's what I'm going to try to do. It's not connected right now. It's actually finished, so I have to restart it. So I'm going to start the same flow again. But now I'm going to connect out. So now what's happening is I'm going to send it a counter value. While it's doing that loop, I'm going to hit it with a big EM pulse. And I'm going to read out what's coming back. See what happens. I'm not going to change anything here. Let's turn this around. Oh, there's already an interesting sound. So I'm going to just quickly pause it, because otherwise you can't see. So remember, the first two bytes is actually the counter that we're sending, so 30-30. And you see that the device is responding with all zeros instead of A5003030A5. And that basically tells me I crashed it, which is not very useful typically in an analysis scenario. But I blasted some energy in it, the thing crashed, so at least it caused some kind of effect. Things get a little bit more interesting up here. So what you're seeing here, I don't know if this is readable for you guys, but the first two bytes is again the counter value I send it. Then I get some A5 response, and here you see instead of it responding 30-30, it responds with 30-31. So for some reason, because I blasted it with power, it's incremented the counter value one too many times. Strange. The one up here is even further off, so the counter is almost double the value of this one. So all kinds of strange effects are happening. Now the fact that this is not consistent behavior, because all the green ones, I'm also blasting it with energy and nothing happens. There's actually two reasons for that. One is because of me, because what I programmed it to do is not to hit the loop at exactly the same time every time, but just kind of different points in time to see when we actually get a glitch. And you can see that here, for each run we have a different, what's called glitch offset. It's basically how long I wait from starting the loop, to when I insert the pulse. So that's varying, which means I'm hitting it at different points in time, which means I'm getting different effects. The second thing here is just nature itself. So glitching is kind of a stochastic process. So I'm not going to get 100% success rate, and I'm not going to have 100% the same reaction. Even if my system is stable, the target might react differently. So those are the two forces at play here. So let's let it go for a little while. So you'll see that there's all kinds of, sometimes it'll crash and it stops for a little while. You see all kinds of funny values coming back there. So this is just to show you that it actually, so I have an EM probe, so I can also change the position of this probe over the chip. So on some parts it will be more effective than others. So if I move this guy now, usually I have this stage hooked up and everything, but I'm just doing it by hand now. You actually see it's not so effective anymore. So I've moved it over a spot now where it's not causing any problems. And you're going to have to trust me that I'm about a millimeter away from where I was before.
I think I saw a whole bunch of red in the middle as well.
You'll see I won't be able to find my spot anymore.
Mark and connect.
I'll have to figure that out later. So it's spatially sensitive. So this is specifically EM fault injection, so I'm generating a very strong field, but it's focused on a small area of the chip. So if I'm not over the area of the chip that's sensitive to glitches, nothing will happen or it will just crash. So I'll go into all the steps here that, you know, for the rest of the afternoon. I think the good thing to remember is I'm doing nothing special on the device except for injecting large pulses of EM. And I'm getting back some, well, at least in the beginning, I was getting back some really different counter values. Later I'll also find a spot again. Still do before a 2-minute break, I guess. I'll also show that you can make this much more precise. So at some point I can start trying to repeat one of those counter values rather than get some random value. At that point, it starts turning more into an attack. Go ahead.
What's the red, green, yellow again? The difference in color?
Yeah, so the green is I got the response as if nothing happened. So I'm getting the correct counter value. Red is some other counter value. And with yellow, it actually detected that the thing crashed. So it's all the zeros is basically I can't read anything anymore. It's dead. So what I've set up here as well is I pull the reset line every time. So the device actually resets every time into the same stage.
So can you deprogram the threshold for those cause displays?
Yeah, so that's just, you can do that in software, yeah. So these kind of things, I mean, now it looks like an interesting toy example, right? There's a number that changes. These things get serious when you think about what is actually happening. So I'm, for instance, bypassing a counter update, which is interesting if you're doing a pin verification on a card, you know, times out after 3 times. If I can affect that part, I can just try all combinations until it says okay, and I just glitch the counter update. It gives me infinite tries. It could even be that not so much glitching a counter update, but you're glitching a conditional branch. So, for instance, if I have the card example again, if I send it a pin which is incorrect, but the actual check whether the pin is correct, I glitch it to bypass it, I'm also in. Right? So there's several scenarios that are very related to this toy example, but are actually quite serious when it comes to security. Okay, so that was kind of my appetizer. Let's start it. So, this small part of the session, I'll just go over some high-level principles of fault injection. So, first the idea is we're going to manipulate the device behavior. So this morning I was really talking about sensing a device, just letting it operate under its own conditions and just trying to get signals out. Now we're actively going to try to make it do something else. And that can mean either process different data values or execute different commands. And we're doing that by changing the internal electrical state of the chip. So we're changing, there's different ways you can approach it, not only EM. You can change voltages, currents, charges, all kinds of things that are happening on the chip, which are normally supposed to be within certain ranges, and we just try to kick them out of the range and see what happens. So the way we do that is we, for instance, we control the power supply to the cart or to the target. We can change that at our own will. So we can increase the power, we can decrease the power, we can do it very shortly, we can do multiple pulses, to see what happens. I just showed electromagnetics, so we have pulses that we can do. In our lab we also have a laser setup. So you can actually hit the chip surface with a laser beam while it's operating, and that way cause transistors to switch. In other words, you're corrupting things while they're going just by shooting it with lasers. Heat is also a problem for chips. If chips overheat, they actually start making faults as well. So you can use that also as an attacker if your circuit doesn't have heat sensors. So there's all kinds of external disturbances you can introduce into a system in order to cause faults. And to give you an idea of what can happen, so let's say we have a chip which operates normally in this example at 5 volts, and we supply the power to it. Now what we can do is at some point in time we just drop power supply for a very short amount of time, and then we bring it back up to 5 volts and then we continue. Now, let's say that accidentally, right at that time, the chip is reading something from memory or from a register or you name it. If that's happening while this power supply is low, it may actually not have enough power to get the data out of that register. So as soon as the next clock cycle hits, it won't have the right data locked in its internal state. In other words, while that operation was happening, we dropped the power and it failed to operate correctly. Now, if we do that short enough, we can target individual operations or maybe groups of operations. And thereby we can, as an attacker, kind of select what part of the program flow we want to attack, which is quite different from environmental impacts. So a lot of the techniques I'll be talking about actually are caused in nature as well. So electrical disturbances, if you take chips, they'll be getting, you know, we get still a little bit of radiation from space as well that hits chips. All these kind of things disturb the chip as well. And modern chips are usually protected against it, so they tolerate some level of these disturbances. But it's at a very different level than we start doing it as an attack. We just have a whole lot more control, and we can up the power to 11, basically, if we want to affect something. So a lot of the same techniques just applied in a different scenario. So a few things that can happen, and we already saw that earlier. We inject a fault and either nothing happens, so we get the nice green bar, it just operates as it does. Not really interesting from an attacker point of view. Second one is it resets, crashes, stops, core dumps, catches fire, all not very interesting from an attacker point of view as well. If I want something to die, I can just hit it with a hammer. It's much easier than using this fancy equipment. So really those last two items there is our goal. So we either want to change the software decision. For instance, am I allowed to access the system, yes or no? Or introduce some computational fault. And that latter category is mostly applied to cryptographic algorithms. So I have a session on it later, but if you inject faults into a cryptographic algorithm, you may actually be able to learn a little bit about the key that it's operating on. And if you do it enough times, you learn more and more and more and more about the key, and eventually you'll be able to reconstruct the entire key. So I'll talk about that later as well. So the different attack channels that we have is, well, there's many more than just on this slide, but just to give you an idea. If the target has an external clock, we can, as an attacker, actually intercept that clock and send it a funny clock. For instance, we can overclock it for a couple cycles. Overclocking basically meaning that the CPU can't keep up with the external clock and you get some kind of data corruption. And the nice thing about that is you can really time it to specific operations. The difficulty with clock generation, it gets a little bit hard when you're doing this at gigahertz levels and up. I mean, there's equipment out there to do it, but it's not trivial to generate block waves anymore. So power VCC, I gave the example already of dropping the voltage very shortly. EM, you've just witnessed, so if I blast a large pulse into the device, I create currents, which create different states that are interpreted as faults by the chip. I've talked about laser pulse injection. It's good to realize that you actually need to decap the chip, basically meaning that you take the package part out of it, the black stuff that you see on top. You put some acids on there and some other fun chemicals until you get to the actual chip, the actual silicon, and that's when you can start hitting it with lasers. So it takes a little bit more prep work, but nothing rocket science. And then there's temperature. Temperature is a tricky attack vector in the sense that, you know what I was mentioning before, it's really nice to pick out specific operations to glitch. Temperature is too slow to really target one or a few operations. So it can still be effective in, for instance, an RSA computation. So it's a very long computation, and the type of fault that you're looking for is not very specific. You're just looking for a fault. So there's one or two studies on you just bring your systems up to the level of the temperature threshold, and then you do an RSA, and it kicks it just over it. You get a few faults, and you retrieve the key. But usually in our lab, we don't go there. The top four we do practice. So now that we've injected this fault, there's kind of three different effects that you can have. So one is kind of a transient fault, which is the ideal case. It only happens during that one perturbation. So as soon as I reset the device, I'm going to be fine. Actually, that's also the temporary case there. So for transient, you don't need to reset the device. For temporary, you do need to reset the device. For permanent, you usually have a problem. So especially with lasers, this is kind of a tricky case because it's easy to burn chips. So you got to really watch out with your laser power. And sometimes it's actually quite funny. In the lab, we have it with a camera as well. So you can see where you are over the chip surface. And if you use too much power, either because you click, you set it wrong in your software, or you weren't paying attention, or your chip is really sensitive, You don't see the laser pulse because it's too short, but all of a sudden there's this little black mark on your dye and it's not responding. After that, all the lines are yellow. Let's say it that way. It flatlines. But what we're really trying to aim at is to get these transient and temporary faults. Because it's really nice that you can reset a device and just kind of start from scratch again. Because a lot of these things are stochastic, so I need to try many times before I hit something that actually causes the effect that I want. And the basic issue that you deal with this is that it's hard to predict what exactly is going to happen. So it's kind of like hitting it with a hammer until it does what you want. And it's hard to really predict. One good thing to keep in mind is that you may need a lot of tries to figure out, you know, what the exact parameter, what the exact timing is, the intensity of the pulse, the spot of the pulse, all that kind of stuff. Once you know that, it might actually get a lot easier. So there's, we technically speak of the identification phase and the exploitation phase. So the identification phase is how much effort does it cost me to identify the problem? And the exploitation is, okay, now I have that knowledge, how hard is it to do this on again or do it on the same chip, but the same kind of chip, but a different chip. So there's quite a large difference there. The interesting thing that if you really want to, or you typically aim for when you're changing behaviors, or if you change operations, is to get access right to a chip without having the right passwords. Things like if it has a life cycle stage, so for instance, it's typically devices they get manufactured, then they're blank, then they have to be personalized with your ID key, and they go through programming of the firmware. So there's different stages. They're typically monotonic, so you don't want to be able to go back and program your own key or something like this. So those are things that that you don't want to have glitched. Forging signatures, memory dump is actually quite interesting. So we in the early days of doing this, how many of you guys work with smart cards? So you know the ATR, right? So as soon as you switch on a smart card, it basically says hello to you. But it says, hello, I'm this kind of smart card. You can talk to me using these and these protocols and these speeds. So it's basically a static string of bytes that sends out as soon as it gets powered up. So the way that it's implemented usually is that's a buffer sitting somewhere in memory of the card, and the card will just go in a for loop and send out these bytes one by one. Now, on a really bad early one, you could, just like we were just glitching the for loop of this counter, you could also glitch the for loop of sending out these bytes. So instead of only sending out that static buffer, you could make it just keep on sending out more and more and more memory. So you could actually just have it dump its entire memory, including keys and who knows what was in there. So that was, that's instantly game over in such a case. We don't see that very often anymore, but it's one of those nice examples of that show that fault injection can be really effective. The other side was changing data, so a few more examples there. So, for instance, if you have a key that gets loaded, well, let's say we can somehow glitch that loading process to set part of the key to zeros. So even if we can set part of the key to zero and then we can use that key, we actually have a scenario where we have a partially known key. Worst case, let's say I have an AES, 128 bits. Let's say I can set all but 32 bits to zero. And I know that all those bits are zero. I have a plain text, I have a ciphertext, and I only have 32 bits left of key to brute force. So if I can pick at what point in time I'm zeroing out my key, I can basically reduce my key search space to something really small and thereby find out the entire key. So that's obviously bad. And then the differential fault analysis, which is corrupting the actual intermediate data being computed during an encryption or decryption, or signing, I mean. Sometimes we combine this also with power analysis attacks, but that's kind of out of scope for today. This is, I don't want to go too much in detail, but you can look at fault injection at different abstraction levels. So if we go up into the code level, we're talking about hitting copy routines, conditional switches, loops, things like that you would see at the C code level. But I'm not affecting C code, I'm affecting electrons on a chip. So these extractions, this stuff actually gets affected by processes that happen much lower. So if we go one step lower, what we're affecting are things like program counters, stack pointers, operand addresses, data values and registers. But even there, this is still one abstraction on top of the electrons, or a few on top of the electrons that I'm manipulating. So this stuff goes all the way down. I'm really manipulating physics here. And I get effects that go up, you know, to the code level, which is usually where, you know, the attacks are that you want to achieve. I don't care about flipping a bit from 0 to 1. I want to have access to the chip. But I'm doing that by flipping a bit. So it's good to remember that we're talking about these different levels of abstractions, and also that, for instance, different targets at the physical level require different attacks. So a RAM will require just a little bit different way of approaching it than a ROM, or an E-square ROM, or a register, or a bus, or, you know, these are different components on the chips that will be sensitive to different kinds of glitches. And, you know, to be honest, often we don't really know what we're hitting. Like here, I'm just generating a big pulse, and I'm hitting the chip, and something happens, and I'm happy. But really what the entire chain is of events through it, it's often really hard to reverse engineer what's happening. Now, there was one paper, I think it's FETC, 2 or 3 years ago. It was actually on one of these smart cards. It's not a smart card. It's a card that looks like it's smart, but it's a very simple microcontroller, leaky as hell, you can glitch it. It's really nice for testing. But what they did is they knew exactly what the program was doing, because they programmed it. And what they did is they did a clock glitch, so they overclocked it at some point. And then they basically dumped the state of the registers after that. And what they found is that what the glitch was actually doing was changing the opcode that was going into the CPU. So, for instance, instead of an addition, it was doing a subtraction, or a conditional jump, or a NOT, or an XOR. And depending on the length of that clock glitch, the opcode would change. But this is one of the few examples that I know of where they could actually relate back, like, the effects that they were seeing with the glitch to, you know, the physics that were happening. Really, really nice paper for the guys in, I think it was the University of Leuven. So if you look at when we're using this, well, there's a few nice aspects of fault injection. Typically you don't need that many faults. Once you get the parameters locked down, maybe 1,000, maybe 1,000,000, but it doesn't take that long to do. You don't need that much design info, because it's actually not helping you very much. A lot of it is just pounding the chip until something falls out. And it's really hard to prevent completely. So you can build countermeasures against this. But just like with any security mechanism, it'll only decrease the chance of an attacker getting through. We'll never put it down to zero. There's definitely some limitations as well. So first of all, you need physical access. So you need to be where the chip is. There's we've been talking internally about it was, I think, at DEF CON last year, there was a presentation by a lady who from across the room could burn out not chips, but like electrical switches and things like that, but having a really focused electromagnetic pulse. So we were kind of thinking out loud, can we do fault injection with something like that as well? Maybe. It hasn't been shown yet, but for sure you're not going to do this from across the globe or anything like that. We typically need some kind of logical control, so we want to often reset the device and try again. So that's a mechanism that you need to use, some kind of reset mechanism. There's few cases where you can do this in the blind. So it's nice to get some output from the device, where it's saying either error or not, or some status code. That already helps, but if it's completely dark, you kind of start relying on side channels to see if you're faulted anything or not, but it really makes it harder. If you have to decap a chip, that may leave evidence. So if I'm stealing your new pin and chip card and give it to you two days later with still bits of acid running on it and the chip is exposed, you know something went wrong there, right? So doesn't happen. And yeah, when we get these things in the lab, we usually ask between 5 and 20 samples because we do end up burning a few, especially with laser fault injection. So this is the inherent risk of breaking something, because the whole thing you're doing is you're running it outside of the specs that it was designed for. That's really what we're doing. So there's always a risk that it breaks. So just to go over the high level stuff. So if I have this wonderful algorithm here, so if I'm authenticated, then give me cash, otherwise kill the card. So where would we want to glitch this fabulous algorithm?
In the if statement?
In the if statement, for instance, yeah. So if you are not authenticated, then you still want to get cash. If you can glitch that to be a different direction, then you might still be able to get the cash. Any other ideas? So of course I'm not showing all the code here, but it might also be nice to glitch kill card. So if you can avoid it from killing itself, you may be able to retry all the pins or whatever it takes to get to be authenticated. So even that is a nice one. Often you don't even need to glitch for that, especially if you write it like this. Because what we can do is from the people who are this morning, from a side channel, you can kind of see what the progression of the algorithm is. And as soon as it hits something that looks like kill card, we just take the power off the device. We don't need to do fancy glitches or something, we just make it stop before it's able to kill itself and then just power it up next cycle again. So, that won't be guessed. But you really, and this is where the trick comes in again, it actually depends on the implementation as well. Because if we go down one level, we go to the assembly level, it matters in what direction the conditional is and what the effect is that we're doing. So if we are skipping an instruction, it really makes a difference whether that was an unconditional or a conditional jump. So in assembly, if it's, compare some register to true, and then if that's the case, then give cash. Otherwise, kill card. If I skip the conditional jump, the second instruction, I'm always going to kill the card. So that's not where you want to be. If it's compiled like this, then yes, then you want to skip the conditional. So it's not always obvious exactly how you want to do it. I mean, it's obvious you want to end up at give cash, but there's sometimes different things you need to do. So just one slide on DFA, I'll get into in a little bit more detail later. So DFA is differential fault analysis. And what we're going to try to do is we're going to try while a cryptographic algorithm is running, introduce a small computational fault. Small meaning I flip a bit somewhere in its intermediate state, or maybe a few bits, but not the entire thing. And I actually execute with the same input data. So if I have an AES, I give it the same plain text every time, and I'm trying to corrupt just a few bits while it's operating. And assuming that I can introduce a fault, you'll start seeing that the ciphertext will actually change, because I've introduced a fault, so even though I have the same plain text, I will get a different ciphertext. And the differences that I'm introducing between the correct and incorrect output can actually give some information about parts of the key, or reduce the space of the possible key. So that's kind of the general way that you do AES and DES, triple DES, those kind of algorithms, and you're usually glitching in the last rounds. And that's because you want to glitch at the point where you still have one key addition left before you get the output. Because you're going to try to figure out what that last round key is. You don't want to have like all the round keys in your equations. That gets messy. You just want to have that one last one, so you just glitch around that time. For AES, I believe you need somewhere in the order of 100 to 200 glitches to retrieve a full key. For DES, it's a little bit less, 50 to 100 or so. So you really don't need that many faults to get a full key out. And this this also may hint probably at why in PIP certification it's really important that your AES is a correct implementation, because if you're all off by a few bits, your entire key might be at risk. There's one really nice exception actually, that's for a very specific implementation of RSA signatures called RSA-CRT. CRT stands for the Chinese Remainder Theorem. It basically is a faster way of calculating an RSA signature. But this one has a nice property that you just need one fault to retrieve the entire private key. And it doesn't matter if it's a 2048-bit key or a 16K key or whatever. The math just works out in such a magical way that you can calculate the entire private exponent just with one glitch. And I'll try to demo that later, if I can find the spot again. Any questions at this point?
So, do you cascade crypto algorithms? Are they reliant on the algorithm running in deterministic time?
Do they rely on the algorithm running in deterministic time? Yeah. Is that your question? No.
In the sense that you're doing a statistical analysis of the, what happens over the number of faults if you're unable to put the fault in at the same point.
Yeah. Actually, the funny thing is a little bit of time variation doesn't matter. Because what the attack actually is doing, if I hit it exactly at the same point at the same time and I generate the same corruption, I'm actually not learning anything extra because I get the same output. So what I'm doing is I'm actually, for instance, in the AES case, I'm taking round 10, I'm just, you know, somewhere between the beginning and the end, I'm just going to at random introduce faults timing-wise. So that's for the DFA part. Now, if your algorithm is really wildly varying in timing, as a countermeasure, for instance, it might be difficult for me to hit that round. Right, so I have to do a little bit more work to make sure that I'm synchronized to your execution of your rounds. Because if I'm accidentally glitching after round 10 or before round 9, let's say, I'm getting glitches that don't help me. So if it's really jumping around, that does help you as a defender. Answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so let's look a little bit deeper into our targets. And we'll really try to answer the question where to attack. So I'll give you a quick code review exercise. And the answer is depends where you're going to attack. So all these things affect what you can attack, but there's no rules for, if you have a ARM CPU and a crypto coprocessor, then you must do this. I mean, there's a lot of these things are hard to predict. I mean, there's some simple things, like if you have a hardware coprocessor, make sure that your EM glitcher is over the coprocessor. So those are kind of the arguments. So it's always good to try out different things and get a feel for what's happening and whatnot. So, like I mentioned in the previous session, we'll start from a functional level. We'll identify what we want to achieve, and then we'll look at the code and see how we could potentially achieve this. So we can look for crypto functions, security settings, functional flow of the target, all these kind of things. We'll point you to where you want to inject the glitch. In the end, we're going to have to compile this into a program, which is going to be executed on a CPU, which is going to manipulate some electrons. So that's really where we're hitting the whole thing. So the closer you can get to the actual silicon, the better your model is of what's actually happening. So let's go to a little bit more elaborate piece of code compared to the last one. So the first if statement there is I verify a PIN code. So I do a get PIN, which is, you know, 4 digits that I get from the user. Then I verify that, I compare it to an internal buffer I have. If it says yes, those two buffers are equal, then I set the authentication flag to true, otherwise I set it to false. And then in the next if statement, I'll do, well, if the authentication is true, I'll do a payment for a given amount, and otherwise I will decrease the retry counter. So if you enter a wrong PIN, you have a counter that decreases. I didn't put the code in here that locks up the cards, but typically if you're at 0 tries, then it's game over for the attacker. So what should I be aiming for here?
Changing the odds that you have
Sorry? Changing?
Setting the odd value.
Yeah.
After the first if.
Yeah, so after the first if statement, changing the odd value to true, I'm assuming. So that way you can bypass any PIN code. I mean, you can send any PIN code and you will still get true. Yeah, that's a valid one. Any other ones?
Block the decrease counter.
Block the decrease counter.
Keep
Keep going, so you can try arbitrary number of pins, yeah. Another one?
You can basically attack every line of code except for due payment.
Yes, there's a lot of... actually, in due payment, you could glitch the int amount to be a lot.
Yeah.
Or zero, depending on where you stand. Yeah, and that's a good... Oops, breaking something here. That's a really good observation, that in these pieces of code, there's so many attacking points. And this will compile into even more assembly instructions. So that's why it doesn't always matter so much what you're hitting, as long as you're hitting something in that sequence. At least there's a lot of different possibilities to get to where you want to be. So we mentioned those two, be off or int amount. You can either skip the first if statement or the second if statement. You can hit the verified PIN code, you can hit the due payment, you can hit the decrease retry counter, you can do the brute force if you have that last one. So there's actually so many ways of glitching it. So, yeah, I think the takeaway here really is that for these kind of pieces of code where you're really talking about security, it's for an attacker, it's not so much about finding that specific instruction. It's more about, can he corrupt something in here, and is that corruption going to lead to some advantage for him? Yeah, I think we talked about this. Maybe to go a little bit into the assembly level of it. So if I'm talking about modifying value, you could do that during a bus ride. So these values, they travel over internal buses from, you know, an L1 cache to the CPU or something like that. So you can change the values there. You might be able to change it while it's in memory. You might be able to change it while in the register. Even in hardware, I mean, this looks like one variable in software, but even in hardware, this is living in different places where I can glitch it at different points as well. Skipping conditional checks, there's also a whole range of things that you can do. Typically what happens in assembly is you have some test that is executed, then that updates a flags register, and then based on these flags you decide to jump or not. So if I can glitch the flag register, in ARM there's things called conditional execution, conditional some other ARMs. So if I can somehow suppress that conditional, I may be able to execute things. I can change the program counter, I can change the opcode, I can change the data, etc., etc. I can skip instructions. All kinds of things that at least potentially would lead to an issue. The list goes on, obviously. So, can we do better? Excuse me. So what can we do to make this actually more resilient to fault injection attacks? Any ideas?
Well, the first thing you do is you get rid of two-way state, because that's what time is coming. There are time checks on the use.
Yeah.
And so that's already going to tell you, should have told you your security review, and you should be beating your room back ahead with quite carrying for that.
Absolutely.
Secondly, you don't verify PIN and set the review. You use the PIN to encrypt the value to use it. That's a much stronger construction.
Would that help against against fault injection though?
If the dupayment relies on the key that's got the right value, you can check them unless it comes out to the right value, it's not going to work.
It probably needs to decrypt it at some point, right?
It's more likely if you're inject fault to cause it to fail than you'll inject fault to cause it to work.
Sure.
Because there's space to do it.
Yeah.
That's the first two things I would make it very simple. How much do I go from there? That's probably not good.
Yeah, those are relevant for sure. Any other
ideas? Never do a bit.
Sorry?
Never do a bit, don't check one bit.
Okay, interesting thought.
It's just like, say, 30 bits, 30 bits, chances are like, stuff, one bit, increase the chances.
Yeah, so a lot of security state is here captured in one bit. So there's a flag register, which is one bit. Or there's an authentication bit. You don't want to have that in your code if you're talking about these kind of things. So what you can do is, and I mean the code gets ugly in the software side, but you can, for instance, let's say that we, instead of saying the auth is true, we say the auth is hex value 8.8. And the auth is false, we say hex value 4.4. And then later, instead of checking whether the auth is true, we check whether it's 4.4 or AA. And if it's not any of those two values, then we know we've actually been glitched, because that should never have happened. So you're making the attack harder, but you're also making the detection possibilities. You're allowing for detection. Now there's one tricky thing still, because if I compare the auth to 4.4, in the end it's going to get compiled, and in assembly it's still going to be one flag register. So you may need to do some magic to avoid those kind of situations. But at least for the first part of it, you've made the state more redundant, which makes it harder to inject the fault and easier to detect the fault. Any other ideas? Sorry?
Have two kinds of things at the same. Way of counting that maybe counts on a subspace or a larger space and you need to make sure it's still on.
Yeah, so it's kind of an built-in integrity mechanism. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's just interesting.
For instance, things like initializing variables to a negative case and then checking through the check if it could be based on the positive case. Or first decrease the retry counter. And then if everything is over and everything was finally checked, then increase it.
Absolutely.
Or always negative first.
Because right now, again, I can still do the trick where if I somehow detect in the side channel that I need to decrease retry counter phase, I can just pull the plug on it and retry again. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you first decrease the retry counter, store it into E2 prone or something non-volatile, then do the checking, and if everything is okay, then you increase the retry counter again. You prevent that attack. Because if I tear the card, or tear the power, I never get to the increase of the value, so after 3 tries I just walk.
Yeah.
Other ideas? I can probably skip my countermeasure session at the end if we keep it up like that.
I know a few people get this idea.
So the decrease of try counter, as you mentioned, is in there. I think all of the answers I heard here were valid in terms of making it harder, and I'll get into that. All of these typically come at a performance cost. So you either have to increase the number of operations that you do or number of checks. One very common countermeasure against fault injection is to just double check. So maybe going against your advice, well, I would still collapse these two if statements, but I would maybe do the ifs multiple times. Because fault injection, like I said earlier, it's not 100% successful. So if I have to glitch 3 if statements to get to the place where I want to be, it's going to be a lot harder than if I have to glitch 1. So that really helps. One tricky thing that gets in your way there for sure is compilers. I mean, optimizing compilers. Because they will look at the logic of your code and say, hey, this if statement is equivalent to the next one, is equivalent to the next one, so I'll just collapse it into one conditional branch. So we've seen that happen as well, where in the C code you have nice fault injection countermeasures that all get optimized out. Look at your assembly as well when you're looking at these kind of things. I'll just walk through this one. So this is when we're actually doing a pin verification. Just to again indicate, every line of code pretty much has a problem. But anyway, we start with saying the number of digits that are okay in the check is 0. Then we have a pointer to the buffer we're going to check. Then we run a for loop comparing the user-provided pin with the input buffer. For each one, we increment digits OK. And then in the end, we check if the number of digits OK equals 4. And then we respond with error or not error. So we can change the value assigned to digit OK. So even if we glitch that to some value, perhaps we can be lucky and have it at 4. We could glitch the input pointer to point to the pin buffer. Maybe not so likely, but theoretically possible. We can keep looping. So if we glitch the I smaller than 4 conditional, we can keep looping this until digits OK equals 4. Any idea how I would know that digits OK would be 4? Anybody remember the pin example I gave this morning at the side channel session? So there's actually a conditional branch there that's saying if pin I equals input I, then do something, otherwise don't do something. So if I can detect that in a power trace, for instance, because the power goes up when I increase the digit OK value and it goes a little bit down again, I can count how many times digits OK has gone up. And then as soon as it's 4, this is a very elaborate attack. I probably wouldn't do it this way, but I mean theoretically this is a possibility. So I could also skip that conditional and do it 4 times. I could skip this conditional even. Or I could just change the response code in 9000. So which one of all of these possibilities would be your favorite one? Which one would you pick if you could? Yeah, if you can get to the memory, that is, yes. Yeah. But let's say that you can't, and we're glitching. So which one of these would you pick? Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
If it's a height, then you
need to flip one bit, basically, right? Yeah.
Can I use another part of the heat by changing the part of the loop?
Changing what of the loop?
The maximum of number.
The four.
You can replace the four by one, or just playing with one heat.
Yeah. You still need to get digits okay to four, though. Otherwise, you can't get to the bottom there. Right. The thing about this is that not all glitches are made equal. So typically it's easy to set like easy. It's easier for a byte value to fall to all zeros or fall to all ones than it will be exactly four. The chance that I can glitch the input pointer to be pointing exactly to the value in memory where the pin is stored. That's a pretty small chance, but that's going to be some complex value. I could definitely skip the conditional inside the for loop, but then I have to do it four times.
But the file is going to generate code that doesn't jump zero on the digits or k equals four, so you whack that you're home.
Exactly. So that's the easy one. So when you look at the one you mentioned, so that if digit equals four, that's just going to be a conditional jump, one instruction. And I can corrupt it into many different kinds of instructions which have, you know, the effect of nothing, no op, and then I'm through. So even though we have all these theoretical possibilities of what might happen, there's still going to be a subset, the ones that are actually practically going to be exploitable. So just to put that in your mind, you know, before we saw all these possibilities, every line of code has a glitching possibility, but it's not quite that bad in practice, at least.
So you told us earlier there was evidence that opcodes are the thing most likely to be
on a specific card, yeah.
And knowing what I know, I suspect that's because you're having more effects against memory interfaces than growing column drivers being more sensitive than other things. Yeah. And you fetch every opcode, but those values, digits, okay, and are things likely to end up in registers over there, and so in straight up logic and not in memory.
Yeah.
So you might want to be thinking more
about testing the instructions
than the data.
Yeah, we see mixed. So for practice, we see mixed things. So we do see the opcode corruption. However that happens, we see things turn into no-ops or into crashes, so probably something gets randomized in the opcode. But we've also done some experiments where it doesn't completely exclude the opcode argument, but we basically had an ARM core, we glitch it, and then we dump all the registers. And we see that by playing with the glitching parameters, we affect different registers. So it could still be that we're changing the opcode into something else, but it could also be that we're affecting different registers.
So this one might actually be good candidate for not coding.
Yeah.
So in ARM, you know, you just write the condition bit.
Yeah.
And it'll get you straight through.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's really what you're looking for. In the end, you're looking for the one glitch that will bring it to you. And that's where, when you think about countermeasures, so I was mentioning before, do three if statements. But you really gotta carefully make sure that you're still not creating some kind of single point of failure down the line. So if your if statement fails, you really want to get out of that part of code. So I don't glitch again or glitch multiple if statements or have one flag that you set in the end based on those three if statements. It's not a trivial exercise to make this into not a single point of failure. Here we actually do have an example, not for ARM, but a colleague was nice enough to compile it for x86. And here you see that if digits okay, which is the top code there, which says move the digits okay value into the EAX register, then you compare whether it's 4 and then it says one instruction that says okay or not okay. So if we hit that one instruction, the J and Z that you see, we're potentially in.
And there'll probably be another one jump of a new test in response to that.
Yeah, so again, so this returns somewhere,
yeah.
And then, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And then that's the tricky part. So one of the, and this is more recent academic terms, is you can use something called effective computing, which means that you are keeping some kind of state, and if you corrupt that state, your algorithm will still keep on running, but it's just all corrupted and you're never going to get to where you want. But it's not this one bit that says yes, you have access, or no, you don't have access. So you can, for instance, imagine that if later on you decrypt something, that, you know, you keep a state flag which you XOR into the key or into the input or something like that. So even if you glitched it, you're not using the correct key anymore and you're not doing the proper things. There's different ways of solving that. For an attacker, it's really easy to see the difference between these binary states, especially if you have like a really different code path. You can see it in a side channel. Often you get error codes, so you know from the output whether something is correct or not, and that really makes, you know, performing the experiment easy. Any questions before we go into tools and 2 minute break? Okay, let's do a few minutes break.